A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about his in-law's historical book collection. A late family member bound and preserved the whole thing. And Daniel, being Daniel, immediately wanted to catalogue it. But he ran into the tension that sits at the center of this whole topic. How do you label something you're not supposed to touch? His own books get a sticker on the cover. No hesitation. For a collection of historically significant volumes, some of them brittle, that approach is off the table. He's been looking at Library of Congress preservation guidelines, at what suppliers like Gaylord Archival stock for exactly this use case, and he wants to know what the actual best practices are for getting an inventory identifier onto a historical book without damaging it.
The core problem is simpler than most people think, and it's not about the adhesive. It's about reversibility. Everything the Library of Congress recommends, everything the Northeast Document Conservation Center puts out, it all flows from one principle: whatever you do to that book, someone in 100 years needs to be able to undo it without leaving a trace. That's the whole game.
So the sticker I'd slap on a paperback is out, because the adhesive soaks into the fibers and yellows the paper over decades, and removing it pulls the surface off.
Right. And it's not just the adhesive. The sticker itself is a problem. Most commercial labels are made from wood pulp paper, which is acidic. Over time, that acid migrates into whatever it's touching. The book cover, the end paper, and you get what conservators call acid burn. Brown, brittle, exactly where the label was. So step one is eliminating anything that off-gasses acid. That means the label substrate itself has to be acid-free and lignin-free. Lignin is the compound in wood that breaks down into acid over time. Remove the lignin, you remove the time bomb.
And Gaylord Archival sells exactly that. Acid-free, lignin-free paper labels designed specifically for this.
They do, and they're not the only ones. University Products, Talus, Conservation Resources, there's a whole supply chain built around the institutional preservation market. But the label material is only half of it. The adhesive is where people really get into trouble. The LOC's Preservation Directorate is explicit about this. No pressure-sensitive adhesives on collection materials. No tape, no self-adhesive labels, no sticky notes. Pressure-sensitive adhesives cross-link over time. They harden, they become insoluble, and they stain permanently. A post-it note left on a book for 5 years will leave a yellow square that never comes out.
So what's the alternative? Because Daniel still needs something to stick to the book.
Wheat starch paste. Cooked from wheat starch and water, nothing else. It's been the standard in book conservation for centuries. It's chemically stable, it's reversible with a damp cotton swab, and it doesn't yellow or cross-link. You mix it fresh, you apply it sparingly, and if someone in 2050 wants to remove the label, they moisten it and it lives clean. The Japanese also have a tradition of using rice starch paste, shofu nori, which behaves similarly. Some conservators prefer it because it's slightly less prone to mold in humid environments, but wheat starch paste is the workhorse.
Coat paste. So Daniel's not buying a roll of stickers and calling it done.
No. And this is where the LOC guidelines get specific in ways that most home organizers find surprising. They recommend applying the label to the inside back cover, not the spine, not the front cover, not the title page. The inside back cover, lower corner, where it's least likely to be flexed when the book is opened. If the book has a dust jacket, the label goes on the book itself, not the jacket, because jackets get separated from books.
That location choice is doing several things at once. It's protecting the label from abrasion, it keeps the exterior of the book visually clean, and it puts the identifier somewhere that a reader has to open the book to see, which means they're already handling it carefully.
And for books that are too fragile for even that, books where the hinges are cracked or the paper is crumbling, the LOC recommends a different approach entirely. You don't attach anything to the book. You create a separate card or slip, write the identifier on that, and house it with the book in an archival quality enclosure. A phase box, a four-flap wrapper, a polyester sleeve. The identifier lives on the enclosure, not the object.
Phase box. That's the folded archival board thing that wraps around the whole book?
Right, made from acid-free corrugated board, custom-fitted to the book. Gaylord sells pre-made ones in standard sizes, and they also sell the board stock if you want to cut your own. The point is, the book itself stays untouched. The inventory number, the barcode, whatever the identifier is, it's on the box. You scan the box, you open the box, you handle the book. The book never met the label.
So there's a hierarchy here. For books in good condition, wheat starch paste and an acid-free label on the inside back cover. For fragile books, the identifier goes on the enclosure, not the book. And for anything in between, you make a judgment call.
And that judgment call is where the NEDCC guidelines get useful. They have a whole technical leaflet on labeling books and paper items. They break it down by material type and condition. Leather bindings, cloth bindings, paper bindings. Each has different surface properties that affect what will adhere and what might stain. Leather, for instance, is porous and can absorb oils from adhesives unevenly. Cloth can be abraded if you try to remove a label later. The NEDCC's advice is essentially, test on an inconspicuous area, first, use the weakest adhesive that will do the job, and document what you did so the next person knows how to reverse it.
Documentation. The conservator's version of, leave a note for the next guy.
It's important. Conservators keep treatment reports. If you applied a label with wheat starch paste on June 3, 2026, you write that down and tuck it in the book or keep it in the catalog record. Because in 50 years, when the label needs to come off, someone will want to know what they're dealing with. Was it wheat starch paste or was it something else? Did someone use methyl cellulose instead? Methyl cellulose is another reversible adhesive. It's a synthetic ether made from cellulose. It dries clear, it's used a lot in paper repair, but it behaves differently from starch paste when you re-wet it. Knowing which one you're dealing with saves time and reduces the risk of damage during removal.
What about the writing on the label itself? Daniel mentioned inventory tags. If you're handwriting a call number, the ink matters too.
Yes. The LOC specifies that any marking on collection materials should be done with graphite pencil or with stable, non-bleeding, non-fading ink. Graphite is chemically inert, it's just carbon, so it doesn't migrate, doesn't fade, doesn't react with anything. The downside is it can smudge if the label gets rubbed. For ink, the standard is carbon-based India ink or archival quality pigment ink, not dye-based ink, not ballpoint pen, and absolutely not felt tip marker. Ballpoint ink is oil-based and will bleed through paper over time, creating a ghost image on the other side. Felt tip markers are usually alcohol-based dyes that fade and migrate. The Sharpie you'd use on a moving box is basically a conservation crime scene.
The permanent marker that isn't permanent. On a label that destroys what it stuck to, applied to a book that survived 200 years until we got to it.
That's the thing. These books have already outlasted the people who made them. A leather-bound volume from the 1800s has survived changes in humidity, temperature swings, insects, handling by generations of readers. And then someone comes along with a piece of scotch tape and a ballpoint pen and does more damage in 30 seconds than the previous century did.
Alright, so the materials are acid-free, lignin-free paper or label stock, wheat starch paste or methyl cellulose, graphite or carbon ink. The placement is inside back cover for stable books, enclosure for fragile ones. And document what you did. That's the core protocol.
That's the core protocol. But there's a parallel question Daniel's prompt raises that's worth pulling on. Why label at all?
He wants to catalog the collection. He needs a unique identifier to link the physical book to a database record.
Right, and that's where the institutional practice diverges from the home practice. Libraries use call numbers that encode subject classification, the Dewey Decimal or Library of Congress classification. A home collection typically doesn't need that. What Daniel needs is a simple accession number, a sequential number assigned in the order the books are cataloged. Book 1 gets number 1, Book 2 gets number 2. The number is the bridge between the shelf and the database. He scans the barcode or reads the number, pulls up the record, and there's the title, author, publication date, condition notes, provenance, whatever metadata he's tracking.
And that database is where the real value lives. The physical label is just a key.
And the LOC's approach to this is instructive. They don't put a huge amount of metadata on the physical label. The label has the call number, that's it. Everything else is in the catalog. For a home collection, you could do even less. A simple 2 or 3-digit number, written small, in pencil, on an acid-free slip adhered with wheat starch paste. It's unobtrusive, it's reversible, and it does the job.
Daniel mentioned barcodes. Is there an archival-grade barcode?
Gaylord sells archival-quality barcode labels. They're made from acid-free paper with a stable adhesive that passes the photographic activity test, the PAT, which is the standard test for whether a material will cause fading or staining in photographic materials. If it passes the PAT, it's safe for books. But here's the thing, the barcode is printed on the label with toner or ink, and that ink has to be stable too. A thermal printed barcode from a DYMO label maker isn't archival. The thermal coating yellows, the print fades, and the adhesive is pressure sensitive. It's exactly what the LOC says not to use.
So if you want a barcode, you're printing it yourself on acid-free label stock with a laser printer using carbon-based toner. Or you're handwriting an accession number and skipping the barcode entirely.
And honestly, for a collection of the size Daniel's describing, a shelf full of books, not a warehouse, handwriting the number is probably the better approach. It's simpler, it uses fewer materials, and it's easier to make reversible. A barcode is convenient for scanning, but it's also a layer of technology that might be unreadable in 20 years. A pencil-written number on acid-free paper is readable as long as the paper survives.
There's a philosophical point buried here about what cataloging is for. If the goal is to track the collection for insurance or estate purposes, you want the identifiers to outlast the current technology stack. A number written in graphite on rag paper will outlast every barcode scanner, every database format, every piece of software Daniel is using today.
And that's actually a principle the LOC builds into their preservation strategy. They think in centuries. The book, the label, the catalog record, all three have to be maintainable across changes in technology. That's why they're still using card catalogs in some contexts, even alongside digital systems. The card doesn't need a power supply.
All right, let me ask you something. Daniel's in-laws collection, these are books that a family member bound and preserved. So we're not talking about a Gutenberg Bible here. These are probably 19th and early 20th century volumes, maybe some older ones, that have personal significance. Does the standard change when the value is sentimental rather than institutional?
The chemistry doesn't change. Acid is acid, whether the book is worth $5 or $5 million, but the threshold for intervention might shift. If a book is already falling apart, the spine is detached, the pages are brittle, you're not going to open it flat enough to paste a label on the inside back cover. You're going to use an enclosure and label the enclosure. The LOC's guidelines scale down to a personal collection just fine. What changes is the documentation. An institution needs a formal condition report. A family collection needs a note in a spreadsheet saying, "Handle carefully, spine cracked." The principles are the same, the paperwork is lighter.
What about the books that have already been damaged by well-meaning previous owners? The ones that already have tape on them? Or old book plates glued in with who knows what?
That's a conservation triage question. Removing old tape is a job for a conservator, not a home cataloger, because the tape has already bonded with the paper fibers. Trying to peel it off will tear the paper. A conservator can use a heated spatula or a solvent poultice to soften the adhesive and lift the tape, but that's skilled work. For a home collection, the NEDCC's advice is basically, if it's stable, leave it. Don't make it worse by trying to fix it. Document that the damage exists and move on.
So the principle of reversibility has a corollary. Don't reverse someone else's irreversible mistake unless you know exactly what you're doing.
Yes. And old book plates are an interesting case because they're often part of the book's history. A book plate from 1890 with the owner's name and a little engraved illustration. That's provenance. You don't remove that. You catalog it. It becomes part of the record.
So Daniel might be cataloging not just the books, but the evidence of previous attempts to catalog the books.
Which is exactly what a professional archivist would do. The layers of ownership and marking are part of the object's story. The book plate from the original owner, the library stamp from the institution that held it for 50 years, the pencil note from the bookseller, all of that's metadata that's physically embedded in the object. A good catalog record captures it.
Let's talk about handling, because Daniel mentioned it in passing, and it connects to the labeling question. If you're putting a label on the inside back cover, you have to open the book. For a brittle book, that's the moment of maximum risk.
The LOC's handling guidelines are worth summarizing because they're not intuitive. Clean, dry hands. No lotion, no hand sanitizer residue. Support the book from underneath when you move it. Don't pull it off the shelf by the head cap, which is the top of the spine. That's the most common damage point on old books. Someone hooks a finger over the top of the spine and pulls, and the leather or cloth tears. When you open the book, support the cover so the spine isn't bearing all the weight. Don't force a book to open flat if the binding is tight. Use a book cradle or foam supports to keep the spine at a safe angle. And never, ever use paper clips, rubber bands, or dog ear page corners as bookmarks.
The head cap pull. I've done that. Everyone's done that.
Everyone has. And on a modern paperback, it doesn't matter. On a leather-bound volume from 1870, the leather at the head cap has been flexed thousands of times, and it's probably already starting to split. One pull, and you've got a tear that runs down the spine.
So the handling protocol and the labeling protocol are really the same protocol. The book is a fragile object, and every interaction with it, moving it, opening it, attaching something to it, has to be done with the awareness that you're the latest in a line of custodians, not the endpoint.
That's the shift in mindset that the LOC guidelines are trying to produce. You're not the owner in the sense of, I can do whatever I want with this, you're the steward. The book was here before you, and if you do your job right, it'll be here after you. The label you attach today is a temporary addition that someone else will remove someday. Make their job easy.
Daniel's prompt mentioned Gaylord Archival by name. What does a typical archival supply order for this project actually look like?
You'd want a pack of acid-free, lignin-free label stock. Gaylord sells it in sheets, laser printable, passes the pat, a container of wheat starch paste powder which you cook yourself. You can buy pre-cooked paste in tubes, but conservators prefer to mix their own because you can control the consistency. A set of small, soft, bristle brushes for applying the paste. A bone folder for smoothing the label down without leaving fingerprints. Graphite pencils. A number 2 is fine, but you can get archival grade pencils if you want to be thorough. And for the fragile books, a selection of phase boxes or 4-flap enclosures in the sizes that match the collection.
And the cost on this is not zero, but not astronomical either.
A pack of acid-free label sheets is maybe $15. Wheat starch paste powder is about $10 for a bag that'll last you years. Brushes, bone folder, pencils, another $20 total. The phase boxes are the expensive part, maybe $10 to $15 each, depending on size. For a shelf of books, you're looking at under $100 in materials to do it properly. And the alternative is damaging books that are irreplaceable.
The economics of archival supplies are interesting because the materials themselves are commodity priced. It's paper and starch, but the supply chain is specialized. Gaylord and University products aren't selling to a mass market. They're selling to libraries, museums, and the handful of private collectors who know they exist.
And that's part of why the knowledge isn't widespread. Most people organizing a home library go to an office supply store and buy whatever labels are on the shelf. The idea that there's a separate category of archival supplies with different chemistry sold through different channels, it's not something you'd encounter unless you went looking for it. Daniel went looking for it.
He found the right suppliers. He's got the LOC guidelines. He knows about wheat starch paste and acid-free paper and phase boxes. What's the thing he's most likely to get wrong anyway?
Applying too much paste. It's the number one mistake. People treat wheat starch paste like glue. They slather it on, press the label down, and the excess squeezes out around the edges and dries as a hard, cloudy residue on the book. The correct amount is a thin, even film just enough to make the label tacky, not wet. You brush it on the label, not the book, and you use a scrap piece of blotting paper to absorb any excess before you position it. The label should adhere, but it shouldn't be stuck so firmly that it's hard to remove. If you've done it right, a conservator in 50 years can lift a corner with a microspatula, introduce a tiny amount of moisture, and the whole label releases clean.
The paste is a temporary weld, not a permanent bond.
That's exactly the metaphor. And it connects to something the LOC emphasizes in their training materials. Labeling isn't preservation. Labeling is an access tool. Preservation is controlling the environment, temperature, humidity, light, pests. If you're labeling books but storing them in a damp basement, the labels won't matter because the books will mold. The label is the thing that lets you find the book. The environment is the thing that keeps the book alive.
Daniel's project has two phases. Phase 1 is getting the environment right. Stable temperature, moderate humidity, no direct sunlight, no pests. Phase 2 is the inventory system, built on reversible materials and documented decisions.
Phase 2 is where the labeling guidelines live. The LOW sees care, handling, and storage of books page, which is on their website, freely available and remarkably readable, walks through all of this. They also have a series of videos on book handling that are aimed at library staff but apply to anyone handling old books. The NEDCC's technical leaflets go deeper on specific techniques. Between those two sources, you've got the institutional consensus on how to do this.
One thing we haven't touched. What if the book has a slipcase or a custom box already? The kind of thing a binder would have made for it.
Then, the slipcase is the obvious place for the label. It's already a separate object, it's handling the abrasion and the light exposure, and the book inside is protected. Label the slipcase, not the book. Same materials apply. Acid-free label, wheat starch paste, or a stable adhesive, graphite, or carbon ink. If the slipcase itself is historically significant, maybe it's the original publisher's box from the 1880s, then you treat it like the book, and put the label on an enclosure that houses both.
The nesting doll approach to archival labeling.
It's not as absurd as it sounds. Museums do this routinely. The object gets a number, the number goes on the object's housing, the housing goes in a drawer, the drawer has a label. There are layers of identification, and the most fragile layer, the object itself, gets the gentlest treatment.
Daniel's prompt mentioned that the late family member bound and preserved these books. So there's a binder's work involved here, handmade bindings, possibly. Does that affect the labeling approach?
It does, because handmade bindings are often structurally different from mass-produced publisher's bindings. A hand-bound book might have a tight back. The spine leather is adhered directly to the spine folds of the text block, which means opening the book stresses the spine differently than a hollow-back binding. If you're pasting a label on the inside back cover of a tight back binding, you need to be extra careful not to flex the book fully open while you're working. Support the covers, keep the spine at an angle, and work with the book only partially open. The NEDCC has specific guidance on handling tight back bindings, and it basically amounts to, be more careful.
The binder's work is part of the book's history too. If the binding is signed or dated, that's catalog worthy.
A signed binding, even an amateur one, is provenance. It tells you who cared about this book enough to rebind it. That's metadata that belongs in the database, right alongside the author and title.
The catalog record for each book in this collection might include accession number, title, author, publication date, publisher, binding type, condition notes, provenance notes including the binder's identity if known, and a note on what labeling method was used and when. That's a rich record.
That record is the deliverable. The label is just the key that unlocks it. I think that's the mental shift Daniel was circling in his prompt. He's not just sticking tags on things. He's building a finding aid for a collection that has personal and historical significance, and the physical label is the smallest part of that system. But it's the part that touches the book, so it's the part where the standards matter most.
The label touches the book, but the catalog touches the future. Someone who inherits this collection in 30 years can open the database and know exactly what they have, what condition it's in, and what was done to it. That's the gift Daniel's giving, beyond just knowing where everything is.
If he follows the LOC guidelines, the labels themselves won't be a problem for that future person. They'll be removable, they'll be documented, and they won't have left stains or residue. The collection will be organized and unharmed. That's the win.
I labeled a collection once. 1993, I think. No, 94. It was a private library in Vermont, about 700 volumes, mostly 19th century theology. The owner wanted everything numbered and shelved in order. I used a pencil and little slips of Permalife bond paper, that's the 25% cotton stock, acid-free, watermarked. Cut them to about 2 inches by 1. Cooked the paste fresh every morning on a hot plate in the guy's kitchen. He thought I was insane. The thing that got me, though, and I only figured this out about halfway through, was that the numbering system he wanted didn't match how the books were actually used. He wanted them in author alphabetical order, which meant the accession numbers jumped all over the shelves. You'd have number 14 next to number 27. Made the numbering useless for finding anything unless you already had the catalog open. I did the labels his way because he was paying me, but I also kept a separate shelf list in a notebook, just the numbers in the order they actually sat on the shelves. gave him the notebook when I finished. He called me 6 months later and said he'd stopped using the catalog entirely. He just used the notebook.
The shelf list is the thing people actually need. The catalog is for posterity.
That's a design question Daniel should think about. If the collection is arranged by subject or by size or by some logic that makes sense on the shelf, the accession numbers won't be sequential. But you can number them in shelf order and use that as the primary finding sequence. The catalog can cross-reference by author and title.
I still have the hot plate. It's in a box somewhere. The Permalife paper, too. I bought a ream of it after that job. Figured I'd use it for something. Never did. But it's good paper. It'll outlast me.
The materials outlast the project. That feels like the summary of this whole topic.
It does. The misconception I'd want to correct, and this is the one I see everywhere, is that archival quality means permanent. People think if they buy an archival label, it's there forever. The whole point of archival labeling is that it's the opposite of permanent. It's designed to come off. Reversibility is the standard, not durability. If you can't remove it cleanly, it's not archival, no matter what the package says.
The second misconception is that this is complicated. It's not. Acid-free paper, wheat starch paste, a pencil, and the discipline to put the label where it does the least harm. The LOC spent decades refining these guidelines, and they boil down to about 4 rules.
Daniel's got the right instincts. He found the right sources. The rest is just doing it carefully, one book at a time.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the hot plate story, we didn't know we needed.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.